You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 26th of May 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Today we're looking back at the week gone by with Monocle's Tom Edwards, Chris Lord, Henry Rhys Sheridan and Marcus Hippie. From the terror attacks in Manchester and Egypt to the future of NATO to awkward political handshakes, pushy photo ops and politicians body slamming reporters. Those stories and more on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome one and all to Midori House. As on every Friday, today's programme features an all Monocle panel of experts. My guests today are Chris Lord, Tom Edwards, Henry Rhys Sheridan, and a little later on, Henry will depart and be replaced by Marcus Hippie. Welcome to you all. We're going to begin with a look back at the week's top story, which was, of course, the terror attack which took place in Manchester on Monday night. And Chris Lord, you sped up to Manchester early on Tuesday morning to cover that story for us. 22 people died, many more than 60 injured, some of them very seriously still in hospital being treated. Your reflections on the week?
Well, I think, first of all, personally, reflections, obviously I'm from Manchester originally, so this had a particularly personal resonance for me. And also on a sort of broader level as well, you know, I've run Monocle's office in Istanbul for the last 2 years and seen attack after attack after attack in that city. And it's been fascinating in a way to see the way a city grieves that isn't in Turkey, that isn't at that nexus of terror like Turkey has been for the last 2 years, actually isn't used to terror attacks and hasn't had one since 1996. So to see the way that city sort of came together and to see the way that the country responded has been very, very interesting. I think, you know, as I mentioned, I am from the city and I remember the last time a terror attack took place there in 1996 in the IRA, when the IRA came and bombed Corporation Street. And what was interesting about that attack in many ways was, nobody died in the 90s in that attack. But also lots of people do say that in many ways that was a break with Manchester's past, and the aftermath of that in the years afterwards, the city centre got massive regeneration projects come to it. And now that is a city, or, you know, where it's quite easy to say its fortunes have turned around. You know, you see offices open up there. When I went there, even just the other day, to see, you know, while everybody's talking about, oh my God, how can this awful thing happen? You look around, there are lots of people who clearly have only recently moved to Manchester, who are not entrenched and have lived there for lots of generations. It's a young city. Stuff is still happening. I'm curious to see how that city's going to power out of this one, I would say.
This is a very, very different attack, though, isn't it? And it's going to be far harder for the city to deal with, because, as you say, it's, you know, 22 people have died, and the way that those people died and the way that they were targeted, the fact that it was that there were so many children, some as young as 8 years old, and you know, and we've all been talking about, you know, different images that stay with us. You know, for me, one of them is the two mothers who were waiting to pick up their kids afterwards, and the kids have survived and they haven't. There's a callousness about this, Tom, isn't there, that it's very hard to do the whole, you know, we're British, stiff upper lip, make a cup of tea, carry on, everything's fine.
That's true, Steve, but I think there's also a level of, you know, depravity, a divorce from reality in these attackers' minds, where it's so difficult to comprehend and process that you are compelled to look forwards. And I think you do have to look at something that is more positive. Now, there's no way you can confront those pictures. You know, the families that are still kind of learning of their losses. There's some people who are so grievously injured they don't know about other losses of their family. Horrific situations. But it was interesting, actually, you know, listening to Chris during the week while he was still up in Manchester. You know, there was an almost palpable sense of community, and clearly there can't be a launch pad for Manchester like 96. But maybe it offers an opportunity to reflect on, you know, how the city is developing, how the community functions, how people from different parts of the world. I mean, Chris pointed out to me that it's the largest expatriate Libyan community outside of Libya, I think. Is it in Manchester or is it over the...
Certainly in the UK.
In the UK, which is an extraordinary thing. And maybe, you know, I don't know, are we ever too complacent about how inclusive and how progressive our big cities are, perhaps?
Well, one of the things, Henry, that's striking about this is that often when these attacks take place, there is a call from those more to the right of the spectrum who say, well, look, you know, Muslim communities need to do more. They need to stand up. They need to, they need to help us rid the terror from their midst. And quite aside from the fact that often that's utter nonsense. In this case, you have someone who on five separate occasions, people he knew, people within the community, in the Libyan expat community in Manchester, contacted the authorities and said, we have serious concerns about this individual, and nothing was done about it. Now, we can talk, obviously, about, you know, the numbers of people on a watch list and whether there are the resources to look at everyone there. But do you think, as inevitably we're in an election campaign now in the UK and this is going to be front and centre for the next couple of weeks, do you think there's going to be more discussion on what security services are doing and what governments are doing in terms of funding rather than these sort of rather stale old conversations about Muslim communities and their responsibilities?
No, I think that those stale considerations are actually going to remain close to the heart of the conversation. A lot of the criticism that has been going on in the press in the days since the attack has been aimed at this prevent wing of the government's counter-terrorism strategy, which precisely pertains to what you've been talking about, placing an obligation on Muslim communities, in particular to flag up individuals who are under threat, or they consider to be under threat to the relevant authorities. And there have been a lot of people, both from the communities themselves, but also within the police force, across society, who criticise that particular measure for making Muslim communities feel like they're under siege. And it's completely understandable where that criticism is coming from. I mean, one point of contrast, another one that I was going to draw between the earlier IRA shopping centre bombing and this one, is that with the IRA, you know, you had an organised political force who, you know, you could meaningfully target as a government. With this latest bombing, you know, we're dealing with a completely different nature of adversary in, you know, this nebulous Islamism, which manifests itself in the minds of individuals. It's very difficult to figure out how precisely they're connected to it. There is no one hub. It's an altogether different and more challenging challenge.
I think one thing I just want to add to that is that there is a bigger conversation happening in the north of England and in Manchester especially about what police do with information that they're given, I have to say. Because at the moment, one thing that's maybe not clear is that up there in the UK, in the north of England at the moment, there is a big conversation about those grooming gangs in Rochdale, especially a part of Manchester, of North Manchester. Recently, the BBC ran a long series, three-part series, about this, a dramatisation of what had happened in this event when a group of men managed to coerce lots of young girls into, essentially, into a sort of sex ring, basically. Now, what has been absolutely key to that and in connection with this is that a lot of people up there in Manchester right now, as those guys are going back onto the streets, are asking, when social workers flagged it up, when members of the security of the social services said there is a problem here with men, in this case, unfortunately, Muslim Pakistani men grooming young girls in that area, why did the police not listen? And what you're talking about there with regards to this being flagged to police over and over again or to the right services that there is a problem with this guy, why didn't the police listen to him? That is honestly a bigger part of that conversation that's happening in Manchester right now.
And Tom, there's also this issue that, you know, when we talk about integration, often we don't talk about the fact that this works both ways. Mm. And that, you know, we still have police forces in this country that do not reflect the communities they serve. You know, in London 20 years ago, you had the McPherson Inquiry, which stated that London's police force, the Metropolitan Police, suffered from institutional racism, and that they had to go through certain steps to ensure that the police force looked more like the community it serves. it's a bit better, but it's still not great. And that's just London, where it's been through this. We also have faith schools that have been encouraged by successive governments, which again ensure that children are growing up cut away from people who are not like them.
Steve, there's a fundamental problem, I think, in this country, which is about a lack of representative sort of cross-section. Now, that's whether you look at Parliament, it's whether you look at the police forces, it's whether you look at local government, it's whether you look at all these different institutions. I think until people feel a sense of, I don't know what you'd call it, almost a more empathetic relationship, or certainly like they were on the receiving end of a more sympathetic relationship, it's very hard to see much progress. And I think in both the examples that Chris has given, there are problems because people say, well, yeah, hang on, we did our side of this bargain. We flagged these things to the right people. Again, you know, the imam, I think, of the mosque that this guy used to attend said he was booted out some time ago, you know, coupled with his international travel, coupled with a pretty transparent relationships within his family, certainly in Libya, and also those who have left that country with other, you know, extreme elements. His trips to Germany, to Dusseldorf as well, which was a bit of a hub in terms of recruitment for Daesh. I think there are plenty of red flags, but I think fundamentally, you know, if we want to try and do something positive as a society, we could try and reflect the communities better, and that would surely drive all of these narratives in a better direction.
And listen to those communities, I think, Tom. That's from what you just said, I mean, that would seem to be the takeaway from it, is that we need to be listening to those people who are plugged in to these things and can communicate and want to be part of society.
I want to look at, before we move on, at how people move on from a terrorist attack. And it's striking, Chris, isn't it, about it makes a huge difference about whether you live in the city or from the city that's affected. So, you know, if you were in London on July 7th, 2005, when 52 people were killed here, that affected you and you remember it and you aren't going to forget it. But if you lived outside London, maybe not. And I get the sense that already with what's happened in Manchester, it was only 4 days ago. And yet, if you're not from Manchester, if you don't have a connection to the place, has your life really changed much? Do you actually just sort of carry on as you were before? Not in a stiff upper lip, I'm carrying on before, but actually you probably don't think about it if you're going out for a drink tonight.
No, I suppose not, Steve. I guess not. I mean, I think, you know, I understand what you're saying. I do often think that this question of has the world forgotten somehow is a little bit over.
I don't mean as in it's wrong that the world has forgotten. I just wonder whether actually we...
Are people thinking about it right now?
We sort of think too much that sort of this is going to dramatically affect the way people go about their lives.
Well, I guess so. I mean, I mean, in many ways, I think you are right in a certain sense, is that, you know, you're right, it's 4 days later, and in some cases people are not going to be, if we walked out of this office now, people are not going to be, oh, I'm not going to go to the pub tonight because I'm worried that there might be a terrorist attack. No, I don't think so. Having said that, I do genuinely believe that I think this attack was so horrifying in its enormity. Just when we started talking, when Tom said about, you know, the level of depravity that was there and the target that was there, I honestly, you know, despite the last few years where we've seen this continual ramping up of the number of terror attacks all over the world, there's something about this, I think, that has touched people as Henry mentioned, a lack, a complete nihilism, a complete absence of any kind of political agenda, direction. We cannot make sense of it aside from pure cruelty. There seems to be no political dimension to this.
I mean, I think that's right. I think this attack, because it was targeted at young people and it was a particularly soft target, it's brought home a reality that's actually something which confronts populations. You know, if you're in Iraq, we've seen football pitches full of kids being blown up. We've seen attacks on markets or schools or hospitals, you know, pediatric hospitals being destroyed. Sadly, that is a reality for people in what we'd term, you know, these more volatile parts of the world. But to see those sorts of institutions targeted in the West, it does, I don't know, it definitely to me felt like a departure. But I guess, you know, this will be something that maybe, you know, the French wrestled with over the last 18 months or 2 years when they began to see a targeting of these soft targets of young people, of leisure activities, I guess you'd call them non-political targets in a sense. And I do wonder whether this is a bit of a moment, if only in the sense that it does make people realise that nowhere is off limits anymore. And maybe, again, if we can try and find some small positive thing, it's that maybe it will make people, again, shy away from complacency. It'll make people review security arrangements, how they're contributing to how their society, their local community works. But that is a reach. I think for the time being, it's still too soon, and a lot of the hurt is just too profound.
Absolutely. I mean, one thing I just want to add to that is just what has struck me as well this week is that despite the conflict in Syria, despite everything that's happened, the fact that you have the coalition fighting Islamic State, going in, clearing them from Mosul, from Raqqa, all these places, despite all that, we still actually don't know what Islamic State is, do we? Like, we don't know, because when this happened, the immediate thing was, can the security services determine whether this is a lone wolf, a guy who gets radicalized through whatever reasons and decides to take things into his own hands? Is he part of a network? And how big does that network go? Does that go all the way to Mosul? Does that go all the way to Raqqa? How in communication is he with those people? And it amazes me.
But it doesn't need to be now. Yeah, we're in a stage now where this isn't like, you know, Al-Qaeda, where there is some guy in a cave in Afghanistan who is leading things. This can be a small group of people that, you know, have certain views and have learnt how to make bombs.
But we still don't know actually how organised it is. We still just don't know. Like, we just don't know how many people, even in these small splinter groups. And you're right, Steve, there is not. And this is the great difference between with Al-Qaeda. But at the same time, we still actually just do not know how strong of a network there is, even in these little splinters.
And this is precisely the contrast that I was trying to draw with the IRA earlier, except we don't actually fully understand, in the fullness of its complexity, as a phenomenon, Islamic State, or as a phenomenon, Islamism. We don't actually know what it looks like, or even like really have a very well defined set of terminology to refer to it. That's always being contested.
What's the objective? The language you speak about. There's not even an under. You may absolutely disapprove of the end game and the methodology, but say with Irish republicanism, the objective at least was clear. You could understand what people were doing, however misguided they were. In this case, that doesn't apply at all.
Okay, let's move on. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Still with me here in the studio, Chris Law, Tom Edwards, and Henry Rees-Sheridan. To Brussels now, where Donald Trump visited this week on the fourth leg of his first international tour as president. He met with fellow leaders from NATO countries. And yet, rather than express his support for Article 5, NATO's principle of collective self-defense, Trump lambasted his allies for not spending more money, the 2% of GDP that each NATO member pledges to allocate towards defense. Chris Lord, so let's look at what Donald Trump has done this week. He has he's made nice with Saudi Arabia. He has made nice with Israel, although at the same time also slightly offended Israel by talking about intelligence that Israel collected to the Russians. He has criticised then most of his European and NATO allies, including Germany. Does this count as a good week for him?
I guess it is a kind of good week, Steve, in a certain way. In as much as, I mean, I think, you know, I read in a lot of the regional press in the Middle East, I think Trump actually has come off much better than he seems over here. I mean, I would say certainly over there. I think the Saudi reception and the way he somehow managed to sort of operate there has actually impressed quite a lot of people.
But that makes sense, though. You know, this is a billionaire autocrat who, you know, let's face it, in the Gulf, a billionaire autocrat is
familiar ground, you mean? Like, yeah, I guess so. I mean, what struck me the most about this story is that, if you remember just back to December, just back to the end of last year, the whole world was terrified, or was sort of, you know, wringing its hands about the idea that Trump was basically going to drop NATO altogether. You know, was going to pull out. This was some of the fears. I mean, I remember when I went to Estonia to report a story there, and that was the big concern. I was like, oh, what is this going to actually mean now? Now we're seeing this. I mean, in a certain sense, I mean, we have to ask this question that Trump is talking about, this 2% of GDP that he's talking about. Isn't it a little bit scandalous that Germany doesn't put that kind of money into its defense?
Oh, yeah, but come on. You know, There's a reason why Germany doesn't spend a huge amount on defence. There's a historical reason why Germany has shied away in the modern era from having a modern military which spends as much as other major European countries.
But what about does Donald Trump's reading go back that far? Only mid-20th century, but I wouldn't be surprised if he didn't know the ins and outs of that particular episode.
No, indeed. But also, Chris, aren't there... there are ways to go about this. And so, for example, Barack Obama has talked about the fact that he thought when he was president that European allies should spend more on collective defence. This is something that's happened in the past. The issue is Donald Trump thinks that somehow they all owe him money.
Well, I guess so, yeah. But I mean, it's all like, you mentioned before that he's in common territory with billionaire autocrats who walk around. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that I've seen Erdogan and co do a million times over. As they go to a foreign place, they know all the cameras are on, they say something outlandish to try and get a bit of airtime. And that's exactly what that is. I don't agree with Trump in what he's doing, all the methods that he's done it here. But I still think to this day that the Bundeswehr could do more in the world. And I think that if Germany had a bigger military and a more active military, when it has got involved recently, especially in the ramping up with regards to the greater deployments in the face of Russian aggression, it's actually done wonders for Germany's soft power. I mean, it's a great thing when it does happen. I think we need to collectively push away from this idea of militaristic Germany.
We're going to speak a little bit later about some of the more interesting photo ops, but Henry Rhys Sheridan, what has been striking from seeing all the different photos and handshakes and so on is how united it seems the rest of NATO is, and we've seen it as well with the G7, with themselves, with Trump sort of on the outside.
Well, I think the most remarkable evidence of that that's come out thus far is pertaining to the G7 meeting, which was today. Apparently, they're not even going to be able to issue a full communique, as is normal, at the end of the meeting, purely down to the profundity of the division between the other six and Trump. They're going to have to release some kind of weird truncated memo instead. I mean, it really is interesting to observe the extent to which his personal presence is changing the dynamics of, the most important international diplomatic forums in the world.
Tom, do you think that this is going to lead to, and we're already sort of seeing this, new relationships or stronger relationships between different allies? So, for example, we've already seen, Macron and Trudeau getting on very well, and we're definitely going to talk about their photos a little bit later. We've seen, the European Union actually in quite a good state, thinking that right now it needs to be really united.
Possibly. I think that the striking thing about Trump, and if you take his tour in its totality, you can see this, was actually he was very keen, for the most part, to befriend people, or more, he wanted to be seen positively. And I come back to this idea of him as this big kid blundering around. He just wants to be liked. Now, I admit, with the stuff around NATO, he has been a little more aggressive, and he rather stuck to what he had said back on the campaign trail. I wouldn't read too much into that. I think he's so afraid of being disliked that ultimately he seems to always get on rather well with whoever is the last person he spoke to, and I wonder whether that will prevail beyond anything else. Around NATO, I think definitely, and if you look across the EU at the moment, there is a moment for coming together. I think Brexit's rattled people. I think the threat, which luckily passed, of a potential far-right leader in France rattled people, and I think it's a good moment for Macron and Merkel and others to restate their shared values and to be seen to be close-knit allies. I think they'll all be pretty happy about that.
Okay, let's talk about some of the photo ops now. And for reasons that definitely made sense beforehand, we've decided to substitute out Henry Rhys Sheridan and bring in Marcus Hippe, who I can only suppose is some sort of a photo op expert. Marcus, hello.
Hello, Steve.
Hello. Should we talk about the photos? In fact, Marcus, we'll give you a moment to get your breath. Chris.
Yeah.
Right, let's talk about, where do we start? Let's start with
a shove, Steve. I think the shove was good.
Let's start with the shove. Donald Trump shoving the president of Montenegro out of the way, who's just joined NATO, so welcome Montenegro, so that he could be at the front. What do you make of that one?
Well, I think the key part is that he's just joined the club, you see. Now, I've recently, as I mentioned, recently come back from Istanbul to the London office here, and as the new
and
guy...
And I shoved you out of the way,
and as the new guy
I,
in the club
day?
Regularly gets shoved around in the halls, you see. So I kind of... I do metaphorically
only.
Metaphorically shoved around and whatnot.
Just metaphorically.
But I can empathise with the president of Montenegro. I think what... It's shocking here is it's that face that Trump pulls immediately afterwards. It's sort of, so he sort of pushes him out of the way, and then he kind of adjusts his jacket and then sort of like gives this sort of
look
strange
at me on the big man.
Smile. Exactly. I mean, it's just an insane level of embarrassment for American diplomacy.
Marcus, let's talk about handshakes, because, you know, Donald Trump has been notorious for his weird, jerky handshake where he tries to rip off your arm. He met his match, didn't he, with Emmanuel Macron, with, first of all, their formal handshake where Trump tried to let go and Macron just held on. And then the other one where which Tom will talk about with a bit more with you in a way, where they sort of pulled this way and that.
Exactly. I have a lot of respect for Macron, because I think it takes quite a lot of balls to actually face Trump that way and actually not give in those things. I see this whole thing as a rather psychological thing. When you read Donald Trump's body language and when you see how he behaves, I start to wonder if he's a great example of what American culture can produce when it comes to the American, sometimes aggressively individualistic, individual culture that pushes everyone to fight for his or her own and kind of pushing forward in the career. If Donald Trump was 6, 7... in a Finnish school or Swedish school or maybe Swiss school, the teachers would definitely look at this kid and think that something is going wrong, and before he would even realise, he would be surrounded by 4 school shrinks.
Tom, my favourite was the Emmanuel Macron walking up to the group of leaders, walking directly towards Donald Trump, and then at the very last moment, just as Trump opens his arms to sort of perhaps give him a hug or give him a shake hands, he swerves 45 degrees and heads straight to the real leader of the free world, Angela Merkel, and gives her a kiss. And then... says hello to everyone before
literally
he goes back
anyone
to Trump.
He can find. I mean, listeners may have to go with me on this, but it's definitely the diplomatic equivalent of the kid feigning to shake hands and then doing the old waved fingers in front of the nose. I'm sure people can kind of see where
we see what you're doing.
I think what's interesting is Macron, I think, has quickly worked out how to rile Trump without doing anything formal, without putting anything on record. And also, he's staying true to his convictions. He's the kind of guy who would say, you know, the person I need to recognise first is the person that warrants my attention, the most deserving of respect.
He might also...
It's plainly not going to be Donald Trump. So he goes to Mutti and to share a bit of a cuddle and a handshake. And then a few
then
other...
Then the Belgian Prime Minister.
Other
and then the again. Luxembourg Prime
couple
Minister.
A couple of hangers-on. I think
over
it's
there,
great. It was masterful. And you saw the dressed-down Trump face. You could almost see some of the sort of... air sort of seeping out of him. I thought it was very, very clever for Macron. I think he's shown exactly why so many people in France have such high hopes for him.
Well, indeed, and it's also, you know, he has not forgotten that Donald Trump backed Marine Le Pen. And what was striking as well, since Trump is such a tweeter, is that footage was tweeted by Emmanuel Macron. He was quite clear, Chris, about like this is, you know, I want everyone in the world to see this.
I like that. I mean, I like it as well. And I can only recall that face that Angela Merkel pulled that time when Trump kind of refused her a handshake in the you know, when they met for the first time. I think it's a very clever way. As Tom mentioned, I think Macron has worked out there are certain noses you can tweak here with Donald Trump. Twitter is definitely one of them, and denying him that little bit of limelight like that, I think it was a very smart thing to do.
Marcus, we've only got 30 seconds left, but joking aside, this is actually important, isn't it? Because all of this shows how perhaps, you know, Europe is united against Donald Trump.
Exactly. It's very important that Donald Trump realizes that when he enters these rooms with all these other world leaders, that he is not necessarily the only person in the room that matters. I think it's very important that these other world leaders are bringing him back to ground, reminding him that he can't actually control all these things by himself. I think the only thing is that I wonder how keen Donald Trump is after all this news and after all this laughter to actually return to any NATO summits to face these world leaders again.
Well, we'll see. We'll see. We'll see where they have him. Marcus Hippie, Chris Lord, Tom Edwards, and indeed Henry Rhys Sheridan. Thank you all very much indeed. That's it for Midori House. It was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Hunter Charlton. The studio manager was Toby Hammond. It's music next. Then Marcus is back with The Menu. Is it very good this week?
It's excellent. This time.
Excellent. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.